I'm Jen Vandermeer. I am the head of services for Doctors Group North America, excuse me, Doctors Group Worldwide. We are the largest social business consultancy in the world. You're all here today, I hope, because of the topic, Brands, the Cost of Being Human. I want to make sure I'm Jen Vandermeer. There's a couple other Vans. I want to make sure you're not in the wrong place. Jill Van Matron is talking about the right to be forgotten, forgiveness or censorship. That's over at the Conference Center. And this really interesting one, Matt Van Horn, adding value as a non-technical, no-talent ass clown. That's not here, so I understand us Dutch people will be fine, but well-distributed across the conference. So this is a story in three acts. It's something that I've been curious about my whole career, which is why are brands so not human, especially now in the social age? A bit about me. I have to confess at the front of any talk that I do, I started my career on Wall Street as a sell-side technology analyst, which a lot of very useless things that I learned, but one incredible superpower, which is I have the ability to measure the ROI of anything. All of you people in this room, all of the chairs, the plushy bowl of carpet, the crystal chandeliers, this whole hotel, all of your iPads, iPhones, and iMacs, and BioWares, and can tell, you know, what our internal rate of return of this human potential is going to be. And it's awesome. I'm predicting a CAGR of like 780,000% just in the next year. I left Wall Street and, you know, old school internet 1.0 design, you know, humanism, became a mommy. And I have the most awesome job in the world. I now get to take that like weird Wall Street view of the world and look at all of this incredible social data through the work that we do and see all the humanity in that social data that is so terribly missing from the data that Wall Street spends all of its time looking at. And that's part of the brand story and why they're inhuman. So brands, a little history for everybody. I had the awesome opportunity to talk to some social business executives a few days ago. Our company had a social business summit, and awesome like social media managers, social business directors, talking about still the, you know, the big story of why we're doing this and the emotion behind it. But for the first year, we really got practical. Like, we've been doing this now for a while. We're not just talking about some lofty vision. We're really implementing it inside the company, outside the company. Really awesome stuff. But, you know, I felt like the real drama wasn't being told. So that night, I got to ask some of those brand managers, social media directors, some serious questions. And I used a technique that I learned in Wall Street, which is if you really want to get a good story, act like a journalist and get people drunk. IBM publishes data on this, and they were talking about it. So it was all tenor, it's all very serious, and it feels, you know, okay, we're spending money on the inside of the company, the outside of the company. But ask 10 Fortune 500 consumer brand marketers over cocktails what they think. And it looks something like this. In 2010, the budgets were fairly small. People, you know, grabbed onto these jobs. It was like a part-time job, so the staff cost wasn't that much. Budgets for media were experimental. There was no commerce being developed, a little bit for tools, a little bit for agencies. And then over the last 2 years, those budgets rose substantially, which very much validates the Facebook IPO, that so much of this money is going to media. So look at this. So staff to manage, you know, I don't know how many of you out there actually manage the social media front lines for your companies officially. Some of the clients I have, you know, there's still like one or two people struggling along. Some have gotten up into the 20s, 25, which is amazing. Talking like massive brands, you know, top 100 on the Facebook leaderboard. But this is the media that's now going behind those efforts, which me and the information design business call the olive ratio. When you see like a dramatic different proportion to something else, and this sets up a conflict, the people versus the media. The social business team, who's been struggling all along, quietly since 2000, whenever I got in, sometime between Friendster and MySpace. And the CMO, who just read about it in Time magazine. Between that person who's working round the clock, 24/7, you know, absolutely wants to respond to customer service inquiries, exhausted. How many of you in this room were like that? Awesome. We love you, people. And the CMO, can I get the icon in cornflower blue? Some of you haven't even read Clue Train, but you know this like pursuit of Markets' conversations, authentic conversations, humanity in conversations. That's what marketing always was, always should be, versus like a madman. You know, it's about the messaging strategy. Authentic conversation is the pursuit of a social business team. Reach is the pursuit of the CMO, VP of marketing. Keep KPIs. Give me headcount is what the social business director is. How many of you are asking for headcount right now? Yeah, man, we need more headcount. And what is your boss telling you? You don't get more headcount until you get me more fans. Which is why there's more media than people. This is a false conflict. It's not real. It's not real. We're doing a dance that was set up for us 50, 60 years ago. A colleague of mine, Dave Gray, this is one of his awesome sketches. He talks about the fact that customers are connecting. Why are not we? There's simple economic reasons for that. We're going to first need to align our visions of what we're trying to do. Because branding didn't really start here. It did not start with these guys sitting back in their chairs drinking cocktails. There were people like us at the beginning of time, at the beginning of the industry, deciding how we would do marketing. And this, for a long time, has lasted as the norm, the practice, the way we do it. It started here. It started with ancient hieroglyphics, human beings wanting to express themselves and document their conversations. It got a little bit bigger with the mechanical way that books were made, wanting to have a little scalability in the model, you know, not just chisel on stone, but something a little bit lighter. And then the printing press. And, you know, a couple years ago, South By was like every single talk had the word Gutenberg in it, because it was like, this is the time that we're in right now, the dawning of the printing press. Created the conditions for radical economic and political change. We're all saying, all us tech optimists are saying the same thing. Social is creating these amazing conditions for change. So why are we still kind of stuck in these ruts? It created a need for them, these guys, the copy guys, who first started the industry before there was television. So they focused a lot on the words. And you see this still. You see a lot of what sort of passes for brand strategy these days is actually copy strategy, just, you know, delicious, wonderful campaigns that pass through, refract like memes through our culture, and we remember them forever. So those guys started before this, but still, there were people like this sitting around, not going to South By, but whatever the South By was at that time, deciding how we would do this. Because whenever there's an advancement in technology, we all come together to figure out what it means, but also how the heck we're going to make money off of it. But it's those two things together that we really must consider scientists. A lot of us tried this so very, very hard back in 97, 98, 99, 2000. I was at a company called Organic. My founder of Dotches Group, Jeff Dotches, started Razorfish. We really, really tried hard to transform the world. Everything that could be digital would be digital. And we stepped on each other's toes. I spent a lot of time in rooms right now that I spent in 1999, 1998. The first time I worked with like an information architect, and we couldn't figure out how that person worked with the front end engineer and the copywriter and the, you know, the biz dev person, and we stepped on each other's toes and our toes hurt. And a woman I worked with once said, you know, she'd worked in the movie business, and she said at the beginning of the movie business, people didn't know what to do on a movie set. But now you walk in and it's like beautiful dance. The gaffer knows where to stand. The key grip knows where to stand. The director, the actors. It's fluid, it's motion, and we haven't yet built that for our industry, which is why it's so excruciating right now. So we did all this hard work. We really tried hard to change the world. We still got into false arguments. And it was really after that time that the business value was found. You know, I'll speak for myself, you know, in one of those digital change management consultancies, which really became an advertising agency later. The business value was really found by findability, Google, not through the awesome transformative work we were doing. The revolution did not actually happen. It has not yet happened. It's happened. Yes, the Arab Spring has happened, and there's a lot of people this week that will tell you the Arab Spring is happening in the enterprise. It's happening in brands, but it hasn't. We have not transformed, truly transformed anything yet. Because we're still stuck in this old way of thinking. And Michael Porter, he's still alive. He still publishes. In Harvard Business Review. In fact, he himself has become a humanist and talks a lot about purposeful business strategy and sustainability, which is so great. And there's actually nothing wrong with this view of the world that he created. But you'll notice here to the right, that sales, customer service are primary activities, and marketing and advertising are support activities. And that's the way it was designed back in the 50s and 60s. That's the way the companies were originally organized. But something flip-flopped. The media, the marketing, the advertising got more power than the ability to serve. You know, so then time went by, and then this awesome thing happened. How many of you still have MySpace accounts? Am I the only one? Okay. And then yes, so great. How many of you had .edu accounts and got in early? And then this is so great. I love Twitter. I love it. The market moved from here. This is right around the corner from me in New York City, 14th Street, 9th Avenue, near the Ganza Wort Meat Market, where customers would interact with sellers and buy meat. And what's there now? Anyone know?
My office.
Yeah, man, Apple. Good answer. 14th Street, 9th Avenue, 100 years later. Same thing. Same thing. So we really are, you know, we're back to here. We're back to conversation. And so how do we talk to all these people, all these awesome network people? There's a cost for why we're not doing that yet. There's a reason why United is not returning your customer service complaints. I still want to know how, though. This is the whole point of this thing. Why I wanted to do this talk is like for your hardworking community managers. How do I get more headcount? I'm really tired. So here we go. ROI is anything. Write this down. Money in minus money out over money in. I'm going to take you to two case studies. One very complete. One not yet complete. And I'll show you why. So small business and a complex global multi-brand jumbo corp. Food trucks. They're all over Austin. They're all over New York. They're all over Portland and other cities creeping in. The following numbers are imaginary for illustration purposes only. Please do not quit your day job to start a mutton hunting truck or any food truck without doing a thorough ROI analysis. So let's do one. So we have some data here. Food truck social business ROI inputs. This is a four-year-old food truck business. There's one truck. There's still one employee. The percentage of this full-time equivalent staff member dedicated to social media efforts, 10%. So cost, total cost of this employee, total salary cost. Again, they're doing what they love, $14,000 per year, but they've given themselves a 3% cost of living raise each year. Investment in social, they're really lucky. One iPhone early on never dropped in the deep fryer, despite iOS upgrades, still works. Just good for our simple modeling. Some social data. So they put together a social media management system. Twitter bit.ly clicks every time an offer was given to the local community to kind of call out to the food truck, come by, come get your mutton. Foursquare redemptions, you know, special, these are essentially a free service provided by Foursquare for small business to come and redeem, you know, if you're mayorship of the food truck. And, you know, this business owner saw some growth over those years, growth that was substantial for this business owner. Incremental revenue was actually quite amazing, and this was a very enlightened business owner. They weren't measuring single transactions or the, you know, the value of the one mutton minus the cost of the discount. They looked at the right way to view ROI, which is at a relationship level, the yearly wallet spend. You know, one mutton cost $5. It looked like maybe $60 a year, and every one of those people referred another customer. So also a very enlightened way to look at the incremental revenue. Average cost of an additional customer referred. These are metrics you can get in your organization. We know them for most of the brands that we work with. It's meaningful. It's the best output of your ROI. And let's do the ROI calculation. So revenue in, that initial iPhone cost, the cost per year, the 10% of that salary of that person, the profit per year, money in minus initial fixed investment over that initial fixed investment equals an awesome ROI 35 times. This person should have been tweeting that whole time. It was good for them. Some things to learn here. You need workflow to capture ROI data. You need to like change the way people work so they're actually capturing the right data. The value is not in the individual transactions, but in the longer term customer share of wallet spend and referral value, that customer referring another customer who then spends. Really important, ROI does not kick in for you until scale accelerates. So your CMO is not stupid. They really do need you to develop and cultivate a fairly large audience base before any incremental spend is going to be worthwhile. But there are limits to this growth. So let's go to the big multi-brand code. My company measures the biggest brands. You know, we really feel like we're here to help the biggest brands because they really need some help. We stack rank those brands based on their social business performance by sucking in all the social data. And let's look at a fairly typical, you know, large brand social media command center. Anybody work in one of these things? All right. Well, now we look at a really refined and, you know, precious group of clients. Then they have a staff of 11, 33 really nice screens full of engagement and listening tools. But this only yields, when you calculate it, for this very large brand, let's say it's like the size of a Disney or a Red Bull, 0.37 seconds per week to engage each audience member is what they're given, even with this enormous team that's bigger than the team that you're on. 0.25 pixels per audience member is like what's allocated in terms of real estate. So think back to our mutton honey example. There's no, that business owner, small scale business owner, it was really worthwhile for them to cultivate those relationships. The social media command center, they're just never going to be able to get there, ever, with that kind of ratio. So it's a fail. Bigger staffs, bigger they get, the closer they get to failure. You can't staff into capitalizing on engagement at scale. So this is not, okay, so I could end the talk here terribly depressing. But there's hope. So let's get to the humanity part. I saw in the pre-tweet stream some, like, I mean, some glimmer of hope. It wasn't just going to be like some weird brand manager lady talking about brands all the time. So why do we care about this? Like I said, fans spend more on products than non-fans. I have yet to see results from this kind of analysis done where you take the social media audience and you take the customer data, customer value data, and you cross-tab and correlate it. And you see, are the social fans, what are they? You know, and if you've acquired them in a good way and not in some cheesy way. I have yet to see an instance where the fans aren't substantially higher lifetime value spenders, higher referrers, higher net promoter scores than people outside of that fan base. More importantly, sometimes we get stuck in like a loyalty conversation. Well, I don't really want to do social because I'm talking to the customers I already have. And it's actually not about that. It's about this really interesting interaction between those people and the people in their social circles. So, you know, back to Gen's work market and the meat market, the way that we used to market before media was through referrals. And that's actually how we've done it all this time, despite the media. And now we're seeing that in the social data. So people who follow brands on Facebook are more likely to buy and more likely to recommend a product post-connection with a brand. More for Twitter, because Twitter's awesomer. And what this means is, pre-internet brand building really was about meaning. I mean, you know, not deep humanistic meaning, but meaning, like making a connection in the mind of a consumer, a mind shift, awareness, loyalty, love, tapping into the emotional parts of our brain. But this whole time, measurement has been unreliable, slow. To do it through surveys, media mix modeling, Nielsen data, it's not real time. It's not predictive. Internet measurement is, you know, it was hard at the beginning. Those of us that were there before Omniture and ad technology had to do like log file analysis and hand tabulate data. It's very similar to now. Social tools aren't yet there. The most incredible insights we get are deep in the data ourselves. But what we created in the internet was a direct response model. A dollar in gets you $1.26 out. You can measure the whole closed loop cycle. And direct digital marketers, you know, went from being crazy revolutionaries like myself, to very hard-nosed, financially motivated, you know, hardcore business people. It's hard actually to sell social to digital managers right now, because if they grew up in this age, they're like, you know, if it's not a dollar in and a dollar 27 out, I don't care. And they're actually, you know, sometimes the biggest resistors to change inside of the organization. So what social is it's the opportunity to create and engage and cultivate meaning at scale. It's the best medium for measurable brand expression. That means the best friend in your organization, if you're in social, if you're a social media manager, social business director, your best friend is actually the CMO or the enlightened digital marketer who really gets brand. Our job, our collective job, is to cultivate these customers and employees and partners and everybody in the ecosystem and transform them into advocates. This is part of the work that we do. We find advocates. We do it through our software. We do it, you know, using like hand wrangling and analysis and just walking around South Bend and grabbing them off the street. We give advocates interesting things to do together. Some would say, you know, cultivate or activate. We use words like that too. They sound like you're really controlling them. But of course you can't. You really have to serve up interesting stuff, interesting social objects, interesting people. And that's the thing that mobilizes advocacy. And now we can measure the impact of advocacy. I've been doing this kind of marketing, branding work for 7 or 8 years. And it was always hard. My company years ago did South by sponsorships for a car company. And, you know, how would they measure our impact? We had online activity. We sponsored the event. We had cars running around giving people free rides. And they would send people with little index cards. And you would fill out these index cards. You know, this company, do you see them as innovative? Do you see them as a change agent? Do you see them as reliable? And people would tick off these little words, and that is how performance was measured. We were actually measured on our ability to shift the conversation, the words that people were going to refer to that brand post the experience of South by Southwest. That's still how brands are measured. Now we can measure it in social data, and we can do it at scale. So it's really interesting when you start to look at this. And how many of you are like, you know, kind of analyst types, look at the data all the time and try to make inferences? Anybody like that here? I mean, I have these moments when I'm like, you know, deep in a spreadsheet one night, looking at like, you know, Black Friday conversations or a bunch of mommies talking on some baby site. And, you know, I have these like weepy moments of someone saying something really touching, tearful. This never happened to me when I was at Wall Street. If I was crying, it was for other reasons. But I have these moments where I'm like, you know, I'm like in the raw data, the download Excel from, you know, Radiant 6 or whatever we're using to suck it all up. And it's there. It's humanity. You know, sometimes seen in the sentiment score, but mostly seen in those direct quotes. And you see this amazing thing. It starts to transform how I thought about my role working with brands and trying to help them be more human. There's this great study recently published by Millward Brown. Stengel used to be the CMO of Procter & Gamble, a very enlightened ex-CMO. Great brands he found when he did a deep data analysis of what brands are really moving right now at this time, post-economic crash, post-recovery, post-political insanity, all this stuff. The brands as diverse as Method, Red Bull, Samsung, were built not just on innovative product or service ideas, which is the currency of the last 60 years, but on ideals. The top 50 brands pursue fundamental human values that improve people's lives. There's this great definition of marketing in a classic MBA book by Cotter, which is that the purpose of marketing is to meet human needs profitably, which seems so simple, and yet so profound. So some of these things we're trying to tap into. Eliciting joy, activating experiences of happiness, wonder, and limitless possibility. This one's going to make me weep. This is my daughter photographed yesterday with her dog. Oh, she's so homesick. Enabling connection, but you know, you see it in my dog's eyes there. She's connected. Enhancing the ability of people and dogs to connect with each other and cats in the world in meaningful ways. This is not my cat. Inspiring exploration, helping people explore new horizons and new experiences. And evoking pride, giving people increased confidence, strength, security, vitality. And finally, impacting society. How many of you get to work in companies that do those five things or one of those five things? How many of them tattoo the brand on your body? So I'm going to close with that and open up to questions because I saw a lot of my phone was buzzing with a lot of questions. Where do I get my headcount is the wrong question. I'm sorry, it's not that easy, and you're going to fail if you ask that question ultimately over time. Even if you win, you won't win because you're not going to be able to talk to all these people. You're not going to be able to respond to everybody and have those human connections one-on-one. We have to think about this concept of advocacy, of redefining brand strategy, which is very stilted and very kind of heavily weighted in advertising and campaign copy, and move it over to something much more meaningful. If you're further down in the org chart and you don't actually get to talk to the CMO and the person that commands the $100 million, billion-dollar budget or whatever the budget is for your organization, It's time to train up on the fundamentals of like the purest forms of brand strategy. It really is the work of value systems. Strong brands that are deeply connected to value systems, as you've seen, clearly outperform ones that do not. And our job as people on the front lines is to deeply understand how that works, using both our own human connections with people through social, our own human connections on the front line, answering phones, and the culture and the medium of social and all the media out there. Media and advertising, believe it or not, is a friend and will help us. And I see a world not so far from now where all of that media and all of that advertising work will be to the service of the work that we do, to help us find those advocates, cultivate those advocates, and have genuine conversations with people at scale. So it's time for all of us to become performance brand marketers and reconnect the brands that we work for, the advertising that we create, back to ourselves. And gratuitous baby and dog photo. So if you do want to ask a question publicly, step up to the mic. I'll look through the tweet stream. I have another colleague looking through the tweet stream. Thank you, sir.
Okay. I have a question.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about the digital marketer and I'm trying to convince the digital marketer on my team that she needs to be a little bit more flexible because what worked for her last brand might not work for this brand. It's a much younger audience. It's a different audience. But all of the things that she knows, like this dollar in, dollar out.
So she's like a direct, you know, she's looking for,
what's
your conversion rate?
She's like, how are we going to buy people?
Yeah.
And I just, you have to be, it doesn't work like that. And so just on a, you know, not a management level, but a person-to-person level.
So, like learn her tools if you don't know them already. A-B testing, you know.
Okay.
Isolating. Yeah. So, you know, I want to run two experiments. I want to see what happens when we more heavily focus on the conversation and the human response while also purchasing the media. And then do another test where we really just focus on, you know, Facebook ad buys and optimizing those. And what happens, what's the difference? And what we've definitely seen is you need all of these things optimized together for the ecosystem to work. And that's, you know, what you have to do is deeply understand everything that they've learned, understand what their boss also knows, and so you can talk to your direct boss in that kind of, you know, control group sort of way, curve it through the data. And someone like that, they're gonna have to work more incrementally to get more spend. They're not gonna have these big aha moments, but you might find if you can carefully get to the head of marketing, talk about this deeper emotion stuff, that they're gonna be touched enough to kind of open up the gates for you.
Thank you. Hi, I was just wondering if you believe that all brands can be humanized, or if you're talking exclusively about consumer brands, and if that is something you believe, what's some advice you'd give to, you know, a brand like Halliburton or Blackwater that's been shamed out?
They just need to invest more in their social media command center. It's the perfect question for our age. I mean, you know, these are brands. They have brand equity. They're attached to some very old ways of doing business. What's interesting is they don't have to actually do anything. The brand has been humanized for them by our laughter. Like, we form the opinions of Blackwater and Halliburton. Like the brand value is out there in the world. So to actually humanize those brands, like, you'd have to take it back to the very core value system of those companies, understand what that means for society.
Is that doable for them?
Is that doable?
Or is there a point at which it
any company, any founder, absolutely. Like, you know, you've seen some transformation for consumer brands like Starbucks and Dell, who had these moments of, you know, what have we become? And it took the founders themselves to ask those very fundamental questions and shift to become more customer facing and more deeply connected. I mean, you know, Halliburton, Blackwater, whole other story. You know.
Maybe bad examples.
Yeah, and frankly, the hardest part is the dichotomy between what Wall Street expects because of the financial data they're seeing, and what we see in the social data, and what we kind of always knew to be true. There's going to be this interesting point in time. It's already happened when BP had their crisis. It affected the stock price. not just because of social media, but all of a sudden the social data was a measurable force. And, you know, while that wasn't really plugged into anybody's stock analysis back then, it had, like, you know, this sudden sense of this problem wasn't going to go away for them. People are actually going to stop going to the gas pumps and BP because of this crisis. And so you see instances of that happening where there's a connection between those two things. There's a concept in Britain when companies were early first formed that you had an obligation to create, to deliver a service, not just make profits. And I think that's becoming true. We're showing, because we can now see the response of society to the work of brands in the world.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, as you were talking about sort of driving more incremental revenue and things like that with social, if you think, or if you've seen in your research, how maybe the traditional purchase path has changed, or sort of what role now Facebook or YouTube or Twitter or whatever else may come sort of plays and how it fits in.
Yeah, there's a lot of work. Altimeter just came out with something I did yesterday about the dynamic customer journey, how discoverability is changing. I would assume to be that whole thing. I mean, we look at the same kind of thing, customer journey. You know, it affects, and you just have to look at simple stats like Pinterest's effect on, you know, for last click referrals into a commerce site or media site to know that it's changing the way people find things and start correlating a lot of these things to the business that you have. So it's going to change things, but I do want to say that right now at the current adoption, the e-commerce metrics are, for the most part, kind of pathetic because we still are not yet at this grand scale. And the bigger lever is actually in storytelling and brand and creating meaning at scale. Those are the metrics that start to impress someone higher up in the organization. And very often, I don't know if you've had this experience, when you show the results of some kind of click analysis or attempted attribution analysis for social to the digital marketer, they're like, you know what, that's pathetic. There's like, it's a rounding error in my overall budget. So you have to be careful not to just make it about that like direct response, but about the larger story.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Hi, you mentioned that media is growing pretty faster than the humans. Do you have some really great examples of how media really supports the human element or the human story?
Yeah, we did this thing for Levi's last year, the water tank app, you know, Facebook app, custom Facebook app, large media to support it, very social humanistic product idea, but beautifully integrated, a waterless gene, giving money to a water charity in Africa, and a social game designed to get maximum participation, you know, share with your friends, all those usual tricks, with a fairly massive media buy. And actually what was so interesting, and now I'm going to tell the opposite story also. So they lined up for a nice media buy, but the social sharing aspect of it, because people were intrinsically motivated to share, I believe, you know, back to their like deepest sense of values, they had this media block there, but they didn't even have to use the whole thing because the social aspect was so successful. That can happen too. But the media amplifies and refracts the, you know, what's going on in that core social experience in such a way to get people there, to increase that findability, to amplify. And if you guys know Facebook ad buys really well, I mean, there's really interesting ways that you have to redesign experiences to take advantage of sponsored stories and things like that. And so you have to think about your experience not just as like a digital designer would, sort of unique singular experience, or even singular plus share it out to your friends, but the whole way that someone was going to come across this experience, either intuitively on their own through finding it, being a fan of the page, or because, you know, frankly, more likely someone got there because they're actually responding to a fairly effective and compelling ad in the social systems. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about the social business index. It's sort of a cloud for enterprises. Can you take us inside that a little more? How does it work? Mm-hmm. Are you measuring that? How are brands using that data inside the organizations to kind of...
Yep. So it's a giant, big social data, big aggregator thing for all the world's top brands. So it's actually free, the index itself. If you belong to a brand, you can just sign up and say, like, I work for, you know, Dell, and get in there. What we decided to do, and we built this thing through customer requirements, really. What we heard from everyone was the thing they were having a hard time measuring was what's really moving the needle. What we see in the social data is what's moving the needle is all of the things that make up brand health. So we measure things, you know, social proxies for things like mindshare, brand love, brand advocacy, And then we look down into the actual, down to the conversational layer to see, like, what is impacting those ultimate scores. So, happy to have you guys look at it. Socialbusinessindex.com.
As a follow-on, I get a lot of questions from execs on what's our share of voice.
Yeah.
And I don't have that data. My argument is, well, we don't participate at zero. So, is that something that's in the SBI?
Share of voice, I mean, you can get that from a lot of tools right now. It's an awfully thing, easily thing to gain. And I'll give you just some examples I've seen. I've looked at like retailer brands over the holidays. You can easily gain share of voice by doing a cheap contest giveaway, or having spam bots in it, or constant iPhone giveaways. Really, really cheese ball. Get $5 off right now. That doesn't necessarily cultivate long-term relationships, long-term conversations. I've even had clients call last minute saying, "I know a competitor is killing me on my core KPI, share of voice, but they're using all these stupid tactics. You know, I know this, but I'm being gold on share of voice. So can you help me with some cheap tactics, please? Something really short term to help me gain the. I seriously had a conversation with a respectable brand, and it was just like." Well, of course we'll take the money. It was very enlightening to say that like we've got to be so careful about the KPIs we choose. Sometimes either thrust at us by others. Share of voice is an indicator, but it's just that.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Hey.
I don't think I can. I'll repeat your question.
But my voice will vary, and I don't know that my question is microphone worthy.
awesome.
Judging by how fast.
Uh-oh.
I promise I don't need it.
It's been recorded.
That's okay. Here you are. I'm sorry. I remarked that too.
How about now? Judging by how fast everyone was clicking around me, are you going to post your presentation by any chance?
Yeah, I'll post it. I'll delete a few slides. That's okay. But yeah, I'll post it.
Will they be the meaningful data-oriented slides that you'll be including?
You mean the ones that were in there that had data on them?
Yeah,
I'll do those. I mean, luckily there's nothing proprietary in there, so there's nothing I can share. I thought you were like holding it against me that there was no meaning or data in my
slides. I was judging.
See,
I'm judging. I'm over here judging you.
Old school South by Southwest.
And will you tell us where you're going to post it?
Yeah, I have a website, jenvandermeer.com. I'll post them there.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions?
Yeah, I got one over here.
Yeah. I'll repeat his question.
Yeah. Sometimes it seems like a way you can change up so the content you can say it in different ways to see if it works. Sometimes it's how you say it. So we have an issue with one of the as a brand that takes basically the books on where we can lay our logo.
The message.
And you don't want to give that up. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to convince people that, your brand will be fine. The meaning will still be associated to your company if you take away some the actual traditional branding.
That's such an awesome question. So I'm gonna rephrase it or try to just really repeat it. So if you're trying to, send basically probably Facebook updates and things like that.
Right.
And there's times when you can do things that are very humanizing, kind of speak in a genuine, authentic voice in response to the customers. And there's times that you can be much more brand-like in the way that you do that. And how do you make the argument internally for, really actually the brand view? And it's something that I've seen in the early social media gurus will say things like, just be yourself. Be more human. Put your face, photo up there and talk about things the way you would talk about them as a human. And they're missing the point when you're actually working for a big brand. You absolutely do miss something there. The challenge is there's not a single major brand today that was, other than Facebook and Twitter that were created for the social age. So there's no sense of fluidity and adaptability in the way copy strategies have happened. So you almost need like an agile copy strategy. In working with some brands, we've seen it take some time, like 3 to 6 months for, like a serious brand to really do that transformation. Sometimes we've been doing it for them. Sometimes they've been doing it internally. We learn it in both directions. It's like fascinating. And the goal is really for like the upper white quadrant of something that has responsiveness, has high engagement reach and scores and participation value and redemptions and all that stuff. And something that is also expressing the brand. And, you know, when I look at, like, the content metrics every month, it's always bizarre. It's like, oh, that stupid little poll that didn't have that much brand content outperformed, like, the thing that I really wanted them to look at. And you know, sometimes then brands fishtail, and they start doing, like, okay, tons of polls. We need more polls. And it's really, you know, what it means for those of us that grew up in this industry is there's certainly, like, that early advertising area copy strategy is going to be critically important to understand, like, how do you create this, create a personality for a brand that's human, that's adaptive, that's flexible, dynamic, that's driving something that is absolutely differentiated and distinct over time. Those of us that do it for ourselves know that that's hard to do. Doing it for a company is harder because it's distributed across a number of humans. But it's, you know, the way I personally changed my view of the world is I used to just think, oh, community managers, be yourselves. And we started to bring in more of a copywriting, method and madness into the process.
Hi. So I'm pretty sure that there are some sessions on this, but what's your response to legal teams that would argue that the cost of being human is actually a lot higher, that it's a lot more risky?
So, you know, like, actually responding and saying, you know, you're right, we're wrong, and that kind of thing, you know. Yes, activists.
What's the argument?
You're correct, we have been deforesting the rainforest and screwing up, there's so many that I've personally been part of. Okay, so, I mean, I've seen this time and time again, that you can actually look, and actually it's something I'm looking forward to our tool, like, showing. You can actually look at events like Crises Attack, you know, attacking a company, Greenpeace, MoveOn.org, whatever the political organism is, attacking a company. And very often they'll attack a set of companies. You know, they'll go after a bunch of retailers that do the same thing. When Nike was first attacked for sweatshops, every single sneaker brand was making shoes in that same region, often in that same factories. And they went after Nike and the others, but Nike's the one that gets all the attention. Same thing happens now with each and every one of these social activist, you know, attacks for rainforests, for political donations, for anything. And so you actually have, there's really good data out there. You can see, you know, if you've been tracking this stuff in your social media monitoring tool, different retailers and how they might respond to an attack about political donations, different consumer packaged goods and when they're attacked by Greenpeace. And the companies that respond fast and honestly have less of an impact on their crisis than those that do not. It's just quite simple. I have yet to see an incident where that hasn't happened. Almost every single crisis, there's something like this happening. And that's the biggest argument, which is actually will decrease in response. Now, that often requires very fast and rather profound transformation at the topmost level of the organization to make a commitment to a change they have not yet made. I've seen companies do it. I've seen companies not do it. The ones that actually say, okay, like, we actually didn't know about that, you know, supplier to that supplier to that supplier that was deforesting the rainforest. Let's change our policy and make a commitment to sustainable, you know, production of that specific thing that we need. When they've been able to truly transform and make that change, it's been, it's transformed the way even the activists who might have been attacking that company for the last 40 years think of that brand and think of their interaction with them. So, you know, like the cost of being human, it's like, you know, it's not a simple story. But when there are some really profound examples out there of where that's happening. And I give, like, Nestle as a great example of that. Okay, awesome. Yeah.
So for the second case study, mm-hmm. was it because they end up putting everybody in one room and they spend all that money?
So the question was, yeah, is it because everybody in one room spending all that money, was that why?
Was that why, like, the cost tank?
I mean, it could be a distributed team. You know, it's an interesting example of the command center because you can actually measure the pixels that people are looking at in addition to the human beings in the room. So, you know, is it just because of that? No, I mean, most of the social teams I've seen are distributed. The point is more, the more successful you are at cultivating a large fan base, there's actually, it's infinite, the amount of the team you'd have to then staff to support that infinite fan base growth. It starts to reach its limits to scale, probably around 5-10 million fans. And the incremental human cost to service that fan base gets out of control. If you think of it as the job of the company is to communicate to the constituency of customer base. So you have to see it as an ecosystem. Customers, employees that are not on the social team who are participating, and programs you can do inside of companies to get people to kind of participate of their own accord. Constituents like resellers or depending on the brand that you're in. And think of that whole ecosystem and how you're going to do marketing differently to kind of cultivate that conversation that's positive for you.
So that would be the way to lower that crazy cost versus have everybody in the room to actually count the pixel.
Yeah. I mean, no, not against command centers, but,
Just a quick technical curiosity question.
Yeah.
What do you think is the best software monitoring tool?
Software monitoring tool? What's your goal?
My goal?
Yeah, what's your business goal?
My business.
Or your personal goal, okay.
Social media manager.
So your social media manager?
Yeah.
So how are you measured? Like, what's your...
What's the software that I use?
Well, no, like, what does your boss tell you to do? Like, what's your number one goal this year?
Just sell more data deals.
Sell more data views, interesting.
Daily deals.
Daily deals.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You're going to want to actually... So there's, like, actual online interaction with your stuff, and you can measure the throughs and things like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I would say, monitoring tool is a secondary tool for you. You actually want some kind of content management tool where you can put in ref codes and measure links all the way through, and then a good search tool on top of that, so you can search how people are responding, not just quantitatively, who clicks on what, but content-wise, why they click on it. So I'm not going to sit here and endorse Rating6 or Spreadfast or anyone who's got it. Because it's really about your specific business, your specific needs, and what you're trying to do. And if someone who is being measured in daily deals is coming to me saying, what should I listen for? You should be looking for how people interact in relationship to what you're saying.
Yeah, these were already,
but
we also like to monitor all the conversations.
But yeah. And then you should use the social business index. Wow, I never got to pick a product. I'm going to take this one and then rephrase. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm wondering what kind of experience you've had with heavily regulated industries.
Financial services, and pharma.
Yeah, I mean, humans don't typically say, we can't talk about that. how do you bridge that gap when you're regularly being asked to engage in those spaces, and you also can't really vilify the regulation?
Mm-hmm. So in each one of these industries, what industry are you in? Are you in one of these?
Biotech
pharma. I would say for each one of these, financial services and pharma, there are brands that have said, we're not going to wait for the FDA to tell us what to do. We're just going to start doing this because the need is so great from our constituency base. I've seen some amazing work from Sanofi in the diabetes space, putting human beings on a blog, on a Twitter stream, being active and responsive to conversations about specific drugs that they have. And it's the only way to enforce change in a highly regulated industry is for those innovators to get out there and really set down the opportunity space. Excuse me. And everybody points back to them. In financial services, everybody points to American Express. Sorry. So if you're inside one of these companies and there's a failure to adopt, the best thing you can do is show that it's actually a competitive threat to not respond. You had a question?
Sure. You spoke about being embedded, tearing up as you're reading some of the data reports. But at the same time, you know that digital marketers are looking for click-throughs and things of that sort. What kinds of APIs do you try to assign to those moments when you're tearing up in bed? In general terms, obviously. And I understand it depends on the brand.
Sometimes I'm crying because it's like personally meaningful, which is personally meaningful. I take that moment and that's my own KPI.
But where's the value?
The value is...
You tell a client, this is the value of me tearing up at night as I'm reading this engagement.
There's truly no commercial value to me tearing up at night. But what is meaningful is if there's insight from what's being said. The digital marketer's boss, the brand manager, is often looking at really amazing, it's a decent brand, consumer insights reports gathered in field or in online research, deep ethnography, doing videos and getting quotes from consumers saying things to get insights so they can innovate on the marketing and the product. So it's those moments when you actually are tearing up because there's something insightful there. Like, look at the way that they're talking about this, beautiful promotion we did. That you grab that quote and throw it in your deck. And it's got to be a PowerPoint or a keynote. It's PDF. They're not going to look at your dashboard. Time for that. And so, and you start telling the story in that way. So this past year, you know, this past month, you know, page views went up by this much, fan count up by this much, and participation rates up by this much, and look what they're saying. And it's actually been quotes like that I found that drive more more senior level executive excitement than the actual data itself. Secret trick from Wall Street also. Yes.
So I work on a global brand, and we're 1.5 people that work on social internally. Mm-hmm. And I also drive myself to that, and I think the amount of information coming through is absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. But advocacy is very much at the core of what we do, is getting other people to talk about our brands. And do you have any other examples of brands who are doing really well in that space?
In advocacy, I mean, I love some challenger brands. We had some brands present at our social business summit, US Cellular and Discover Financial, who are, like, not top in their category, who see advocacy as the way that they interact. Brands that have natural advocacy built into them, like Target, Starbucks, do really interesting work. Red Bull is the classic brand that is a client of ours that they built their whole brand through advocacy programs before there was social even. So direct identification of those advocates, inviting them in to create the story with them on the ground, online. There's some great stories out there. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, we started early, so you guys get to go early. On to your next panel. Thank you all.